Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me at the Brain and Language 2021 conference. Today, I'll be talking about intergenerational neuroimaging of reading and dyslexia. I would like to acknowledge all our supporters, and you can look at it here and also check out our lab's website for more details. We have, but I just wanted to say here that I have no conflict of interest. This is our lab members. It's almost up to date. I haven't had a chance to put in the newest members of our lab here, but again, you can look at our website. And when I'm introducing each study, I will have a photograph of that person on our site together with, on the slide together with a name. So I'll start with an introduction talking about reading and dyslexia in general, about the brain basis of it, and then also how we're trying to step away from neurophrenological sort of approaches to more neurologically plausible multi-systems model of reading and dyslexia. Then I'll talk about some of our work on intergenerational transmission, where parental influence, if you consider that as a multifactorial liability for complex traits, how that reveals allows us to think about biological factors in different ways, and also about our past work on parent-offspring association in brain and behavior. I'll introduce the concept of intergenerational neuroimaging and using a natural cross-fostering design, which we still don't have very good or enough data to present here today. And then I'll talk about how paternal age is the greatest risk factor for de novo mutation. And in that sense, it's also something that a parent has an impact on their offspring. So I will talk about that as a sort of a relevant topic. And these are genetic but not inherited traits. And then I will conclude. So developmental dyslexia, as many of you know, is they have individuals who have dyslexia have significant difficulties in reading, in particular decoding words. It's thought to be neurobiological in origin, even though this is a kind of a funny thing to say, because you think that everything is neurobiological in origin. And it's not due to lack of opportunities, sensory impairment, intellectual, other disabilities, and English as a second language. So this is a typical kind of a definition and a diagnostic criteria for dyslexia. They often have phonological processing deficits, which is the ability to understand and manipulate sound units in a word. But the dominant idea is that not everyone has phonological processing deficits, and it's a multifactorial liability. About 5 to 10% of the population, regardless of writing system or language, have dyslexia. And there's a moderate family history. It is in the general, if you have a family risk, the family history, there's about 4 to 8 times increased risk compared to the general population. And if you have a family member with dyslexia, then 1 in 2 to 3 will end up having dyslexia themselves. So this suggests that there's an intergenerational transmission, which is defined as genetic, epigenetic, pre or postnatal environmental transfer of traits through generations. So just kind of deviating from the intergenerational transmission topic, just more generally about reading and dyslexia and the neuroimaging basis of it. We have shown, and many others have shown as well, but in the temporoparietal region, primarily on the left side above the ear, and then occipital temporal region at the back of the head. And these regions are primarily or thought to be kind of very relevant to phonological processing, and orthographic processing are thought to be atypical in deficits in individuals with dyslexia. We have shown that it's not related to their reading level, meaning that that if you look at children who read at the same level but are younger, so they don't have dyslexia. So they're younger, just typical readers, but they just read at similar levels to an older child with dyslexia. We don't see this kind of atypicality. We have also shown that it's not related to the definition. We looked at a couple different definitions, such as the low achievement criteria, where we just look at reading levels, or we look at discrepancy, where we look at where they are, that you need to have a certain amount of discrepancy between cognitive or IQ. And this was not impacted by this. And we use kind of multivariate machine learning patterns to and multiple data sets to look at this. We have shown also, but even though I just said that the discrepancy or it did not matter in a way, that as long as you were low in reading abilities, you would have these dyslexia-like neural patterns. But if you look at individuals with typical reading abilities, but really high IQ, then the question is whether or not they will have similar kind of atypicalities than dyslexic individuals, because there's a discrepancy, even though their reading ability is within typical range. And this is the case, meaning that even if your reading is sort of normal, but your achievement in IQ is higher, then you still have some kind of atypicality in these areas. We also show that it's regardless of the writing system. If you look at those individuals with Chinese dyslexia in China, for example, you still see similar kinds of atypicalities. Also, this is present in at-risk pre-readers. So you don't have to be looking at individuals who are reading and failing, but if you look at-risk individuals, you'll see kind of similar patterns. Primarily, people have looked at those with family history. And then it seems like in these frontal striatal networks, we have shown that there seems to be a compensatory like hyperactivation going on in these frontal striatal areas, but it's this compensatory network seems to be primarily related to articulatory processes. This is kind of trying to get at the next thing that I want to talk about, which is this is a connectivity-based parcellation of the temporoparietal region that we did. And we look at networks that are connected to each of these parcellated temporoparietal regions. And what we found was that there was less orderly coupling between attention and learning networks in those who are reading more poorly. So as you can easily imagine, it's not just in these isolated regions, but a network and a host of regions and networks seems to be impacted, whether it's primary or secondary. So as I alluded to already, these kind of phonological orthographic systems seem to be impaired in individuals with dyslexia on average. Of course, there's a large individual differences. And then some have suggested, as well as us, that there might be an increased articulatory kind of network and activation patterns in the frontal striatum. But there's a large number of processes that are involved in reading, as you can see here, and it's not just orthographic and phonological processing, but there's a number of others. And in particular, domain general networks are involved, such as the dorsal attention network, as well as the executive function frontal parietal network. But we gradually want to move away from these narrow phrenology type approaches where we're trying to identify sort of the dyslexia region or phonological processing region, but think about it more from the systems level and the neurobiological kind of causal level. So this is what we proposed a while ago on the neurobiologically plausible multi-systems model of reading, where we are want to be looking at genetic, prenatal, postnatal, environmental levels, to more cellular chemical levels, macroscopic, anatomical, physiological, and behavior and perceptual cognitive sort of levels that would impact reading. And as one of our efforts, we have proposed a neural noise hypothesis of dyslexia, where we're looking at things in a more vertical, according to this figure, vertical way. And this is what we actually proposed in a Trends in Cognitive Science paper from several years ago, where we proposed that there might be some genetic risks, such as the well-known DCDC2 for dyslexia, and this might impact sort of the glutamatergic system, and not only these migration or others that have been discovered, even though it's a little bit much more complicated than one has originally thought. And this might lead to increasing cortical excitability that might lead to increase in neural noise. Of course, some kind of neural noise is great for signal to noise ratio, to have a better signal detection. But if it's too much, then it could be detrimental and it might disrupt oscillation and other kind of synchronizations between different kind of long-range networks, which might impact, as well as short-range, which might impact kind of perceptual and cognitive processes and eventually impact reading. So people have shown this in different bits and pieces in animal work, and we try to piece this together to propose this hypothesis. Since then, we've done some more neuroimaging research to in order to kind of study this further. And we have a major NIH-funded project going on right now with Ken Pugh at Hoskins and Roland Hancock at UConn. But also we want to be thinking about these in a more sort of horizontal way, according at least according to this graph, where we're interested, where we want to be looking at genetic, prenatal, and postnatal environmental impact. So this is not actually Galabrutter's or Geschwind's work, but it's in their book and written by multiple authors. So this is just kind of a snippet of it, that there are many old observations that are not substantiated necessarily, and in most cases, it was often in small-scale studies and have not been pursued since. But there's some work to suggest that there might be intergenerational transmission and sex specificity. So, for example, people have found matrilineal transmission patterns from mom to boys, prenatal immunological abnormalities found, and abortions and stress kind of impacting poor reading and dyslexia, as well as sex hormonal impact, and some other mechanisms as well. But I just wanted to give you a flavor that there's a bunch of these things that have gone around. Many of them have not been really substantiated with evidence, but there's a lot of room for more research to be done, especially with modern technology. So now, kind of moving more into intergenerational transmission. So we know, and the dominant theory right now is that there are multiple factors that impact dyslexia phenotypes. And this is what we call a cumulative risk and protection model of dyslexia. So there might be a number of different neurobiological risk factors, as well as protective factors and risk, environmental risk and protective factors that cumulatively kind of makes us, allows us to kind of that create sort of this Gaussian curve where you have poor readers to good readers, and the majority of us will fall into this normal reader sort of category, whether or not we like it. And if you're past this particular threshold, you might be more at dyslexia risk, and it will reflect, coincide with the population incidence. So if you consider this liability as a multifactor process, this affords the integration of family information, parental information, and so on to explain individual differences. So according to this thinking, those with more severe relatives, closer relatives, and more relatives are more likely to be poor readers. And this suggests that both parents should confer risk and protection. There's a number of different kinds of parental information, as I've already alluded to. And these kind of investigations of gene environment interactions or impacts could be studied through intergenerational transmission. So, studying the parents and the offspring, you can look at prenatal and postnatal environmental impact, epigenetics, for example, and genetic inherited kind of genetics, as well as de novo mutation, which is heritable but not inherited genetic effects. So this is why I have it in a dotted line here. And these are kind of findings from relatively recently on reading and dyslexia as it relates to intergenerational transmission. So we know that parents predict offspring's reading and dyslexia outcomes. And there's a number of different studies in this shown in kind of white here as a summary. So, for example, family resemblance, there's a family resemblance in reading ability and related component skills. And this is well established with a significant R correlation coefficient. Multiple people have shown this, including our group. And reading ability of dyslexics and non-dyslexic parents predict offspring's reading similarly. Dyslexic parents have more severe dyslexia if their children have dyslexia. And so it's not surprising when you think about the correlation between parents and offspring. And children are more likely to have dyslexia even if the parents are not dyslexic, if the parents have lower reading ability. So even if it's sub-thresholds, the amount of poor reading does matter in how it impacts or correlates with their children. And also, if both parents have dyslexia compared to only one parent having dyslexia, the risk of dyslexia in offspring increases 2.5 times. So this suggests that both parents confer liability, and this has led to Elsa Van Bergen and colleagues to propose and modify the multiple liability model to propose the intergenerational multiple deficit model. There's also findings that in multiplex dyslexic individuals, so for example, if you have multiple family members with dyslexia, then about a third to a half of the dyslexic individuals are kind of fall into this category, according to a meta-analysis from 95 publications. And then if you look at dyslexic individuals, about 8 to 16% of those do have no family history, and it's a singleton, or it's kind of sporadic. When you look at the patterns, the multiplex individuals or dyslexics tend to have more oral language and phonological deficits. And so that's kind of interesting that there might be different kinds of cognitive and behavioral patterns in those with a family history without. So this suggests that there might be different kind of biological pathways and mechanisms. Dyslexia is largely genetically transmitted from parent to offspring with little evidence of environmental transmission, even though, of course, we know that environment and schooling does impact individuals' literacy outcome. There's some older literature that suggests that phonological processing may be more genetically mediated. And orthographic processing is more environmentally mediated. And this figure here that I have shown is taken from the intergenerational multiple deficit model from Van Bergen's paper in 2014. And this just shows the different kinds of G effects from parent to offspring. Investigation of genetic and environmental effects through intergenerational transmission could be interesting because, and we're interested in macro circuits using neuroimaging because reading and dyslexia are complex phenotypes with multifactor reliability, and macro circuits have heterogeneous components with complex interactions. So circuits represent loci where key causes and impacts may converge in ways that lead to complex phenotypes. Intergenerational neuroimaging is defined as a design where mechanisms of intergenerational transmission of cognitive phenotypes from parent to offspring is investigated by basically just scanning parents and offspring. So basically, it's just let's scan everyone from parent to offspring, look at the relationship and brain patterns as well as cognitive patterns. And this is what we call intergenerational neuroimaging, which we kind of talk about a lot in a transit neuroscience paper from several years ago. In terms of from research groups that does reading and dyslexia research, there's two recent papers, either in preprint or in cerebral cortex this year. One is from Nadine Gabb's group. And what they looked at, both of these papers looked at mother-child pairs. So they don't have paternal pairs, but they've done kind of great works looking at mother-child pairs and showing similar brain patterns between mother and child. So in Gabb's group study, what they found was intergenerational transmission of graph-based cortical cycle patterns show stronger patterns or similarity between child and mother pairs and child and unrelated mother pairs. And this is mostly identified in the right hemisphere regions, and it seems to be stronger for girls than both boys, particularly for the left regions. It wasn't linked particularly to reading or dyslexia in this study, and they don't have dads in this study, but it's quite interesting. There's also a study recently that's in preprint by Nora Raskol's group. She was a student with Nadine Gabb, and she's done a larger scale study looking at structural brain similarities. And what they found was they focus on the reading network, even though they didn't link it to reading behavior. What they found was mother-child dyads in the reading network was similar for mom and mothers and children especially in gyrification patterns, surface area and gray matter volume, but not cortical thickness. And many people have suggested that, relatively speaking, surface area may be reflective of more prenatal impact, and that could be a potential factor as well. One factor that could be contributing these to the null effect in cortical thickness, but stronger effects in surface area and gyrification. So we started, and so those are more recent papers. We started several years ago looking at these intergenerational transmission. And so we first started off by looking at parent and offspring. I don't have the actual results here, but based on research in depression and also animal work, we were interested in looking at the cortical limbic system. And what we found was structural similarities between mothers and daughters, but not mothers and son, or dads and sons, or dads and daughters. So basically, it was unique to mothers and daughters. And so it was quite popular, and it was in the press a lot. And so some Scientific American, for example, wrote up, "Like mothers, like daughters, the science says so too. The new study bolsters evidence for brain structure and mood disorders are genetically passed on from mother to daughter." There's a little bit of an overinterpretation, but this is not horrible. And just a couple, several years ago, I was randomly searching for something online, and what I ended up finding was a Glamour magazine article. So it's usually fashion or kind of a more of a magazine that I would never would have imagined showing up in. So what they have written in this paper or in this article was that they took the results and said, "Feeling extra emotional today? Blame your mom. No one can push your buttons like your mom, and new research has found that there may be a scientific explanation for that. You share the same emotions." So this is my one-time appearance, probably in the Glamour magazine, but they took the results a little bit too far. Also funny, also, but this is kind of our main findings back several years ago. So after that, we started looking more in, after the proof of concept study, we started looking more in kind of reading networks and reading behavior, both in parents and children. And what we found was that parental reading, as with others have found, predicts offspring's brain and behavior, even in pre-readers. So this is looking at graph network analysis in structural brain patterns many years ago. Now it's almost 10 years ago. But what we found, we compared pre-readers with and without family history. And what we found was differential patterns, even in pre-readers, in these kind of temporoparietal sort of and temporal networks in the brain. So the topological properties of gray matter surface area were different, in particular this metric called between a centrality. This is a meta-analysis that Mikey Vandermosten did several years ago. Also, there weren't too many studies back then in pre-readers, but what people, what she has found doing a meta-analysis was that in the temporoparietal and occipital temporal regions, even in pre-readers, if you are at increased risk and have a family history, then you see atypicalities in these regions, even if, even when they, before they're starting to read or as they're starting to read. This is a particular study where we looked at dissociations between maternal reading history and paternal. And what we found is predominantly mothers impacting offspring and not dads. And what we found was mothers' reading predicted pre-reading ability in kindergartners, pre-reading cortical surface area, but not thickness. And these are the results from the surface area in the left temporoparietal region. So the thickness was not related to mom's a history of reading, poor reading, but surface area was, again, suggesting that there might be a stronger prenatal impact on offspring or relationship. And so you see that the more severe the mom's likely reading ability in the past would was related to reduced cortical surface area. We also found that maternal reading ability was predictive of child's reading skills in grade three, explained about 21% of the variance in our study. And other kinds of studies, we've started looking at parental brain, so more and predicting offspring's brain and behavior, so more kind of purely about intergenerational neuroimaging. We have found preliminarily that dads phonological region, sort of the posterior superior temporal region, was predictive of child's reading, and then maternal occipital temporal region was predictive of child's reading outcome. What we also found, so this is the work that Zichao and Cheng has done, and we haven't published yet, but also Maggie Vandermosten has done some work. It's in preprint form right now, where she looked at white matter in intergenerational transmission. And what she has found is that children's IFOF, which is the ventral white matter tract, was predictive of reading development, and it was mediated by the child parental IFOF association. And her interpretation was that there might be pre-existing protective factors in these individuals, especially with those with the family history. Also, you can look at the dyadic relationship, so dyadic brain and behavior relationships. So you could do something like genetic correlation analysis, looking at parental neural patterns and behavior, and look at this coupling and relationship between parent and offspring to look at what's G and what's environmental impact, genetic and environmental impact. We focus on the temporoparietal and occipital temporal region because of past behavioral work in twins, as well as kind of the findings so far. And what we found is that this superior marginal gyrus in the temporoparietal region showed more genetic impact, and then the reverse was true for more of the occipital temporal region, and it was more environmentally mediated, which is consistent with the previous twin studies. So then the question is whether or not we can dissociate these genetic prenatal and postnatal environmental influence. So now you can, with the advancement in technology, now we can start looking at what we call natural cross-fostering designs in humans by looking at those children who are born through artificial reproductive technology. And we introduced this idea in trends in neuroscience several years ago. So cross-fostering design is traditionally an animal model where you can, for example, transfer an embryo to another mom and look at when you remove the genetic impact, then how does the parent offspring association differ. And we can do this now because now about, at least in the United States, about 2% of the children are born through IVF technology. And so for the first time now, we can dissociate genetic prenatal and postnatal influence, previously not possible before. And this is a very simplistic design, and we have a much more complex design, but this is an example comparing three groups. So for example, in homologous IVF groups, then you have everything from the parent to offspring. So you have the biological, prenatal, postnatal, environmental impact because you go through the IVF technology, but I'm still the one using my eggs. I carry through the go through the pregnancy and I raise the child. And so I have all of it, but I just go through the IVF procedure in general. And this is important if we can, because some have suggested that there might be a genetic impact just going through these IVF procedures. If I receive a donor egg, for example, and go through the procedure and have a child, then my child will not have my biological information, but will have the prenatal and postnatal impact. And then, for example, in a surrogacy case, then I have some reasons that I'm not going to carry through a pregnancy. I might have someone else carry through the pregnancy, and then I wouldn't have the prenatal environmental impact. So by applying behavioral genetics approaches or analytical approaches to these data, you can start dissociating these three kind of different pieces. So how about the effects of de novo mutation? As I said at the beginning, paternal age is advanced paternal age, and having a child when you're older, basically older dad, is the greatest risk factor for de novo mutation. There's been a number of different molecular genetic studies done on this, and the reason is simple in that sperms go through much more cell divisions compared to eggs, and it changes and increases throughout kind of the life course. And so this leads to increased de novo mutation and copy number variations. And also, if you look at de novo mutations in the offspring or children and look at whether it was derived from the dad's side or the mom's side, most of it could be explained by the dad's age. So these were some evidence showing that de novo, it's a little bit more complicated and there's different kinds of de novo mutation, but this is the majority in the current kind of understanding. There's behavioral epidemiological research on the relationship between age and reading and dyslexia outcome. For example, there has been more frequent occurrence of dyslexia in dyslexic boys in a very old study from the 70s, and also poor reading was related to advanced paternal age. But there were a number of confounding factors, and the results were sort of inconclusive depending on whether you included these kind of confounding factors, such as SES, maternal age, and so on. So we did, and Zichao did a study, just got published in Human Brain Mapping recently, looking at the relationship between paternal age at child's birth and brain and behavior. So these were the results. What he found was paternal age was indeed predictive of reading outcome in the offspring. And these are the results over here. But then also there was a brain region, which gray matter volume change in the thalamus in the offspring was also predictive of reading outcome. And this is represented in this graph here. And this is quite striking and different from kind of family history questionnaires and these types predicting reading outcome via phonological processing, which is kind of what people have shown over and over, that phonological processing might have more of a genetic component than orthographic processing, for example. But in this case, we found the thalamus instead of region primarily known to be related to orthographic processing. So we were interested in exploring this further. And what we have found that it's located in the region called the pulvinar within the thalamus using the Morrell atlas compared to some other kind of nuclei. And what we also found was that if using Oxford's thalamic connectivity probability outcome atlas, we found that it was mostly connected to the bursera parietal region. Another piece of evidence is when you take neurosynth data and derived data and then take that cluster from the thalamus and looking at connectivity patterns, it seems to be mostly representative of the dorsal and ventral tension network. So then we took another step to look at their each individual child's white matter tract and try to identify whether the fiber tract that goes through the thalamus is more related to the dorsal versus the ventral network. And it seems like it was driven primarily by the dorsal tension network. So it seems to be that the paternal age was impacting reading outcome via a region or development of a region primarily known to be or largely known to be important for the dorsal or the attention. So to conclude, we show that these kind of investigations of genetic and environmental impact can be done through intergenerational transmission. We have shown, and this is a very simplified kind of schematic, showing that perhaps family history, representative more inherited patterns, might be predictive of reading outcome via phonological processing. Of course, it's much more complex than this. But and also, we've shown preliminarily that paternal age, possibly reflective of de novo mutation, might be impacting attention and impacts reading outcome. And then, of course, the other work that we haven't done directly, but previous evidence suggests that there's a strong environmental impact on orthographic processing that impacts these reading outcome as well. Our preliminary results show that when you combine parental reading abilities, which is could be a proxy or has been suggested to be a proxy for genetic impact, home environmental measures using some questionnaires, very crude questionnaires, and paternal age reflective of de novo mutation together predicted 57% of the variance of child's reading ability at grade three. So thank you very much for listening, and I think that's it for me.